Welcome into the show. It is Daniel Ortman coming to you live from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. It is Tuesday, October the 22nd. Welcome into the show. 8 a.m. on the East Coast, 5 a.m. out West. For all of you early risers up, watching, listening to the show, hats off to you. Thanks for tuning in on this Tuesday morning. Coming up after the break, we will be joined by a friend of the show, Jack Gidney. Looking forward to catching up with Jack. So yesterday we were talking and looking at this San Diego Tribune article where Mark Ziegler had gone through looking at the Federation and the problems with the Federation and, you know, why are we having these issues and what's required in order for us to get some improvement, some change. I think I pointed this out yesterday, but I want to reiterate this, and then I want to pick up on some of the conversation we were having yesterday as well. The first point is this, that those of us who want to see change in this country, who want things to be done differently, want it done differently because we want the best for American soccer. We want American soccer to reach its potential on all levels in all areas. I can't say that enough. It is so important that we reiterate that over and over again, that no one can kind of take that stance that those of us who want to see things differently are trying to attack anyone or try to destroy U.S. soccer. In my ideal scenario, what I would love to see happen is for the Federation to get fixed. There's a lot of fixing that needs to take place, but my ideal scenario would be that the Federation gets fixed. It becomes fully FIFA compliant. It becomes a well-run, non-profit, national governing body / Federation in the way that it conducts its operations, in the way that it conducts you know, its finances, in the way that it conducts its sanctioning, its processes, its hiring. In every way, I would like to see this organization be the global standard for every federation in the world in how it's run. At the same time, in an ideal scenario, with all of that, I would love to see Major League Soccer, the USL, NISA, the NWSL, all come into alignment in a connected system of leagues. That is the best case scenario for American soccer. And it's really what needs to happen. We need every club in this country connected in a system of connected leagues. And that connection of leagues is not buy-in fees as its first or primary method of entering a league. That the primary is your success on the field. Your primary entrance into a league is how well you've done. And I would love to see all of our leagues connected. That I just want to get all of that out there. Like, that is, I don't want to see Major League Soccer burn to the ground. I want to see the system function properly. Now, if Major League Soccer says, we don't care, we don't want any part of this, screw all of you, then, you know, obviously that's a different story, but that would be their choice. I don't want them to fail. I don't want them to continue to get away with what they're doing by running the federation de facto from behind the scenes as almost a puppet master. I don't think that's good for the country. I don't think it's fair for the country. I don't think that gives us open access and opportunity in this country. And so those things, I think, need to change. But I want to see the leagues in this country connected. Because for me, it's always and will always be club over league. A league should just be a group of clubs organized to play in a competition together. That's all a league should be. The clubs should be the focus. Jurgen Klinsmann was famous for talking about back at the 2010 World Cup about how the American pyramid is upside down. But there are so many things out of whack because our system is dysfunctional. One area is that too often we talk about leagues over clubs or leagues over franchises or teams. It's a real issue. The Federation has rules in place in how it addresses professional leagues. And it has taken upon itself this idea that there's only one way to run, or a primary way to run, a professional team. And they have dictated owners all the way down to the fact of the amount of ownership shares and percentages and net worths of individuals to be qualified to own a team. And it's such a bad metric of measurement, because when you pigeonhole yourself into that scenario, number one, you are completely ruling out other ownership structures. The most well-supported league in the world is the Bundesliga, that has a 50% plus one fan ownership model built into their system. Those kinds of clubs are not permitted in the United States in our professional leagues, especially at the top levels. Barcelona, supporter-owned club. Real Madrid, supporter-owned club. Bayern Munich, majority, 50% plus one, supporter-owned club. Not permitted in the United States. Bournemouth in the Premier League, small club, small town, would have to get an exception or fall into the 25% of teams in the first division, not in a metro market of a million plus. Eibar, Same thing. Who are we to judge where the great soccer clubs and supported clubs will come from? We don't know. But I would bet that in a country so vast, so large, from a population and geography standpoint, that there would be a lot of places that would not have Major League Baseball, the NFL, or the NBA, that if they had a professional club with the opportunity to play at the highest level, would receive massive support. Support that would be captive, unmatched, because they would not have an MLB, NBA, or NFL team to even compete with. And there are tons of those cities, large cities across this country. We're just not doing the administration, which is the federation's job. We're not doing the administration of soccer in this country very well. We don't have the right leaders in place. We don't have the right rules in place, the right standards in place. There are so many areas where we are falling short. And as a result, we are left with a dysfunctional system, a system that does not operate well, and it creates a lot of bad situations. One of the byproducts, one of the ugly side effects of this dysfunctional system is that it is a system of gatekeepers. At a federation national team level, Major League Soccer is so ingrained, so involved at the federation level, at the top level, that when Don Garber talks about having Major League Soccer be the league of choice by 2022, I'm starting to think maybe he's not referring to league of choice as it compares to competing with the Premier League or La Liga or Bundesliga or Serie A. But maybe what he's actually meaning is that if you want to play on the national team, the league of choice for you to play in is Major League Soccer, because we keep looking at these player selections and they don't make a lot of sense except for the fact that they are in Major League Soccer. Maybe that's what Don Garber means. And we laugh and we make fun of those things, but when you look at how involved Don Garber is at the federation level, the guy earns double-digit million-dollar paychecks off of contracts with the same federation, non-profit federation, of which he is a board member. I don't care if you are the purest of pure souls. That'd be very hard to be objective, being a board member, knowing that your influence and your decisions and your opinions are going to have a direct impact on your multi-million dollar bonus checks because of a contract with that same board. That'd be hard for me to process. It's such a massive conflict of interest. Another area we see gatekeepers pop up is coaching. If you're not familiar with soccer parenting, Sky Eddy Bruce, who's a friend of the show, she's been on the show recently and shared about coaching. On Twitter, she tweeted out a stream of some comments from some parents and what's going on with some coaches they're dealing with. It's not parents trying to complain. It's not parents trying to be a nuisance or bad or cause problems. But they're dealing with an entitled, empowered coach who's a gatekeeper. Yet again, another byproduct of our dysfunctional system. Instead of the Federation ensuring equal opportunity and equal access, we have a system that means that you can do whatever you want. And if you know the right people, you can get a shot. If you have enough money, you have a chance to get a seat at the table. Period. You don't even have to have an existing team to skip the line and go all the way to the first division. It's absurd. We wonder why television numbers suffer. We wonder why people are not showing up to national team matches. It's because whether the public fully realizes it or not, they know something's wrong. For a lot of fans, that level stops at the national teams. They just don't know why, for example, the men's national team is so bad. They don't know why the women's national team doesn't get more support. And so their interest at that level doesn't go beyond that. But that same dysfunction is having an impact, influence on those supporters, those fans. And you keep taking that a step farther, each level going deeper. I mean, we have a setup in our country where we have the greatest women's national team program in the world. And when it comes to our professional council, which is the group of professional leagues that get a vote in U.S. soccer decisions, elections, etc., at national council meetings, we treat our men's professional teams and league in the first division differently than our women's professional league, giving Major League Soccer a nearly three times the number of votes and voting power of the NWSL. Think about that. Our top professional league on the women's side, not only are they not equal to their male counterparts, clear gender discrimination. But they've even been granted less voting power than our men's second division. It's absurd. But this is part of the dysfunction. It's all over the Federation. If you were to do an organizational assessment, if you were to go through and do an audit of the Federation as an organization, to put this in medical terms, the U.S. Soccer Federation is eaten up with cancer. It's savable, but it's stage four. And it's expanding and growing every day. That's not good. I talked about it yesterday on the show. We need a change of leadership. This is nothing personal against anyone who is on the board of U.S. Soccer or president, vice president, or the top level executives of U.S. Soccer House that operate day-to-day operations. But the facts are, we are where we are, and we need new blood. We need new ideas. We need new leadership. 2 years in, nearly 2 years in, from the last presidential election, there's just not enough progress. I would actually make the argument there's been very little progress. So when we start to make this assessment, we go through and we audit, where's the increased transparency coming from the board? At last year's AGM, we had a policy approved for the publishing and updating of the website when it comes to board meetings. Well, that's a good first step, but there's no bidding or procurement policy. The board can spend money however they want to. No checks, no balances, no accountability, no transparency, no requirement of even getting multiple bids. Nothing published in the policy manual in regards to the finances. Nothing published when it comes to how we treat professional leagues, when it comes to voting power based on gender. Nothing in the policy manual as it relates to our professional leagues in the standards of which they have to operate by. There are a lot of things that are in the dark at the board level that we don't know about. Not published. Not available to the public. Issue after issue. We can be better. We should be better. I believe that American soccer, that the United States of America could be the greatest soccer country on earth. But we have to start making different decisions to get us there. Because what we are doing right now is not working. It is not getting us there. It is not getting us anywhere near reaching our potential. In every league, every team, every organization, there is a massive, massive amount of opportunity out there. It's not about destroying everything. It's about getting everything healthy. It's not about burning things to the ground. It's about getting things fixed. Our sponsor this half hour is DuckTig Brand, DUKTIGBrand.com. If you have not checked them out, they've got some really cool products they've released, and you should take a look at them for sure. And when you do, use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order at DuckTickBrand.com. We'll be right back after this with Jack Gidney. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for tuning in this Tuesday morning, October the 22nd. We are joined by a friend of the show and a friend of mine, Jack Gidney. Jack, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, mate. I officially got my American citizenship last week, so this is my first time on the show as an American, so hopefully I'll be a bit kinder this time.
Dual citizen, right?
I am, mate. Yeah, dual citizen.
Dual citizen. Jack Gidney, congratulations. You now get to vote.
I do get to vote.
And good luck trying to find a good choice in the next election. I don't know that looking over the horizon we have many good options, but you'll get to vote either way, so take advantage and enjoy that experience for the first time while your home country of birth is still trying to figure out and may still be trying to figure out 100 or 200 years from now how to separate from Europe. So
as if it wasn't hard enough to vote in one country, I've made it difficult in both. So I never do things the easy way, mate.
So let's get into some football, some soccer, as we call it here in America for some strange reason. Taking a look, we come through the summer, the U.S. women's national team win the World Cup. Looking ahead, Jill Ellis has recently stepped down, ended her reign as the national team coach. There's been a bit of speculation about her replacement. At one point, Phil Neville's name was mentioned. His name's escaping me, the coach at Arsenal for the women's team. Yep. Have you heard anything on that front? And more importantly, what kind of coach, knowing the U.S. women's national team, being familiar with the landscape and the type of players we have available here and the way that Jill Ellis ran that team for the next chapter, the next cycle, the next season for this U.S. women's national team, what kind of coach do you think the U.S. should be looking at to build the program to an even higher level going forward?
We talked about this during the World Cup. I mean, I think that there's a cycle of players here who are coming to the end for the US, who've been terrific servants and won everything. But they're getting up in age. And so I think there's, over the next 4 years to the next World Cup, there will be a turnover of players. I think, obviously, we talked about nations in the last World Cup that really showed well. And impressed, certainly with the style of football they were playing or how far they'd come in the 4 years. It would be nice to see, for me personally, it would be nice to see a coach come in and bring in the newer crop of players coming through and be a little bit more perhaps progressive with the football they played. I think the US was good in the last World Cup, but not as good as I think they should be. I think it's the best squad in the world. I think if you ask any coach in the game, in the women's game, particularly at the World Cup, you look at the squad of players. I think every coach would have picked to have that squad of players at their disposal. For me as a coach, when I work with a better team, I think the standard that I want to see or the bar is set a little bit higher when you have the best at your disposal. You look at teams in the Premier League, and that's why Man United are where they are in the league, and it's disappointing for them. But you look at teams who scrape and avoid relegation, and they're pleased with it. It just depends on what the expectations are for what you have at your disposal. So I'd like to see somebody come in and bring a younger crop of players in and kind of say, okay, you're the team for 4 years, and we're going to run with it and see how we get on, and, kind of build and their own identity and their own culture on the team. But I don't know. Whoever gets the job, they're walking into just a wealth of talent. And it's a very desirable job to have. It's probably the number one job in the women's game. So
when we look at the landscape of women's soccer here in the U.S. since the World Cup, we've seen attendances grow in the NWSL over the summer, better ratings, FIFA even reporting good ratings for this World Cup that took place this past summer in France. All good indicators for growth of the women's game, which is sorely needed all around the world, and especially here in the U.S., where we have this massive country from a geographical standpoint as well as a numerical population standpoint, but only 9 franchises currently, although there's speculation that 1 to 2 more should be announced here soon, possibly this coming weekend with the NWSL final. When we look at the landscape of women's professional soccer in the U.S., how important is it for the league to continue to build upon the success of the national team from this past summer going forward and growing the number of teams and number of cities in which they have coverage for the league in terms of building for the future to not just be sustainable, but to also raise the standards and quality going forward?
Yeah, I think it's massive. The lack of teams or franchises, I suppose, is the word to use, is baffling. I think that's the first thing that has to change. I know for me here in Los Angeles, and I'm in a hotbed of female soccer, I can't go and watch an NWSL game. I've got to go a very long way to watch an NWSL game. That's mad. Means we're not going to games, we're not watching games, we're not picking up players. We're not getting the revenue in. It's not growing in this area. Instead, we've got 2 men's teams going at it in the semi-final, but no women's team. But this is where women's soccer is phenomenal. The number of teams has to happen. There's a lot of talent in the college game that I think doesn't get enough of an opportunity to find a home. So you look at all the talent in the collegiate game, particularly both with domestic players and players who come from all over the world to play collegiate soccer in the US as a female. They don't have anywhere to go. They're kind of forced into like 30 or 40 spots across 9 teams. There's just not enough opportunity to grow and develop talent and push the game on and push its exposure on and push its investment on. I think that's a real shame. I'm one of these people who thinks these victory tours that US soccer does is a total waste of time. You know, how many times do you want to beat Korea when you could take the best players and the champions and put them in their home stadiums and have more people in their area come out and watch the league play and grow interest in the league? You know, I watch people tweet all the time, well, you followed us in the World Cup, but you don't go and watch the NWSL. Well, all the players that we all want to come and see and all people that are maybe new to the game or only got involved in the World Cup, they can't go and see them in their home stadiums because they're not there anymore. They're off somewhere else beating, you know, Portugal or Korea or somebody. It doesn't matter, just to have a celebration. And I think that is a massive opportunity lost.
I don't think it's as much even a celebration tour as I called it a fundraiser for the U.S. Soccer Federation to raise funds to combat the lawsuit that the U.S. Women's National Team is bringing against them. I laugh as I say that, but there's got to be some truth to this that the Federation, you know, is really
vicious circle.
Right. It's running victory laps and taking the money hand over fist to fight the lawsuit brought on by this very players that they're raking in the fundraiser dollars from. I want to get to something with you that you brought up when I asked you about the you know, growing the footprint, and you mentioned no NWSL teams in California, and I want to talk about that, and I also want you to kind of describe, as someone who, you know, has come from the UK, you're here in Southern California, the potential of Southern California. Obviously, there's 2 MLS franchises that are playing there in the Los Angeles area. You have, you know, the MLS franchise up in the Bay Area as well, and so you've got, you know, 3 teams there, soon to be 4 with Sacramento. there in California, rumors of San Diego eventually landing an MLS team. You've got USL teams. You've got NISA there in California, USL Championship, USL League 2 there. No NWSL in the state of California. Talk about the potential of professional soccer on the men's and women's side, because I talk to people out there in Southern California, people involved even at the state association level, who talk about how even with what is already there at present, still not even scratching the surface of the potential of Southern California in particular, but the state of California at large, in terms of professional soccer on the men's and women's side.
It's absolutely massive. I mean, you know, I am one of the people I'm going to talk about. I'm an immigrant who's come here to Los Angeles, and it's my home. It's such a metropolitan area, and everybody seems to be coming here from all over the place, that soccer is such a huge aspect of where they're from, that people want to have it in their adopted cities. So as far as the growth, it's huge. For the women's game in particular, I find it baffling, because I used to spend a lot of time at youth national team camps watching the men's games, and I could go to it's Dignity Health Sports Park now, I believe, in Carson, and go to a men's youth national team camp. And I remember going in, one of the first camps I went to would have been, it would have been a long time ago. It would have been the Perry Morosevic and that camp. And there's, you know, one man and his dog there, or parents of the players. There's nobody there. You know, I've been watching Christian Pulisic run around those fields, you know, with about four other people for years. But if you go to a youth women's national team camp there, it's packed. All the kids from local clubs come out. There's all little girls of all ages watching the games. There's parents bringing their girls to the games because this is all they have to watch. So the potential is enormous in the women's game. I've been a head coach in the WPSL for 2 years. I'm hoping to be doing it again next year. I don't think that's taken seriously enough. I don't think there's much investment in that. They bought in the UWS the last couple of years, which is trying. But the WPSL, I love the WPSL because it's where the college players go and play in the summer. And I don't think that gets given the respect it deserves because, you know, it's where the breeding ground of top players are at. I've played against some top players in the WPSL. The national team has played against me in the WPSL. And that, again, gets no funding, no money, no nothing. It's an afterthought at the moment. And that, unfortunately, is a real shame.
How many NWSL teams in a California setup, whether that's, you know, Northern California, Southern California, how many teams do you think could be viable in the NWSL?
It's a good question. Two, I would say, from the LA to sort of Orange County area. I think you could probably get away with doing one in LA and Orange County, and one in San Diego. It's really tough because I think timing is key, and culture is key. You know, LAFC did a really, really good job of establishing a culture and a gap in the market that the Galaxy weren't hitting, and they've done it very well. If you go to a game at LAFC, it's a totally different environment and feel to if you go to a game at the Galaxy. So I think they did a good job in that. I think partnerships are really huge, particularly in the girls' youth game. I think there are some of the mega clubs of youth clubs out here that could probably align themselves or maybe push to try and get one of their own that might be attached in some way, if directly or indirectly, that I think could help. I know the Slammers are trying to do it with LAFC. So I think that is a link that's missing. I think the MLS misses a massive trick in not getting directly involved with the NWSL. I know Portland, the guys at Portland do very, very well, because of the partnership between their men's and women's teams. Again, it's timing. Like, if they open two women's teams at the same time, I think it could dilute it a little bit. And you don't want to see one struggle. So I think at this point, when we only have 9 teams and no teams in Southern California, I'd be happy to just get one.
Right. So, I mean, you're looking at what, 2-3 Southern California, maybe 1 Northern California, maybe 2 at most Northern California. But you could realistically look at 4 teams, basically half the size of the current NWSL just in California alone, and yet we don't have a single franchise for the NWSL in California. A little bit of a head scratcher, as you mentioned, a hotbed for the women's game and the game in general. The game at large, and you know, I think it's been an opportunity missed, and I hope that going forward it gets addressed. I think you know, partnering with, you know, an existing team that's operating a men's team, to me makes sense. I look at what's going on.
It's not just that you need an organization, because outside of the soccer, you need the front office, you need the ticketing department, you need the marketing department. You need some sort of organization to back with where you can double dip a little bit. It's not just the pure soccer side of it.
Absolutely.
There's a business element to it as well.
Absolutely. Right. And that's where I was going, was when you look around the world and you see the, you know, the Barca having the women's portion of their club, you see that with Arsenal, you see that with Liverpool and other clubs around the world starting to do this more and more. It's exactly going to what you're talking about. It's a club, it's a holistic thing. It's not just you know, a siloed off or standalone project. It becomes part of the club at large, which does provide some, you know, advantages, operational advantages. Built-in fan base is one of those things that often gets mentioned.
Yeah, brand loyalty.
Brand loyalty, you know, the fact, as you mentioned, you can lower your overhead, because, you know, if you've got a ticketing office, it's probably not going to cost you any more money to run ticketing for the women's game than the men's game. And if so, it's marginal compared to running that as a standalone set of operations. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of things and a lot of good things and advantages to taking a holistic approach to running a soccer club, you know, that we in the U.S. should really be trying to take advantage of, especially having this legacy and heritage of the U.S. women's national team program, the success that they've had. It's been, you know, light years better than their male counterparts. And yet on the federation level, something that has just happened here in the last few days, working with Chris Kessel and the West Virginia Soccer Association, getting a policy amendment to go before the board of directors of U.S. Soccer, and eventually possibly even to the U.S. Soccer National Council at the next AGM in February in Nashville, is a policy amendment that would treat for the first time the NWSL, which is the first division of women's professional outdoor soccer here in the U.S., with the same level of respect, dignity, and treatment as the first division men's outdoor league in Major League Soccer when it comes to voting power within the professional council. And so this amendment would ensure that there would be no gender discrimination when it comes to the voting power within that professional council, which, you know, collectively is about 25%, give or take a little bit, of the overall vote in an election. And Jack, just to put this into perspective, in the 2018 election, the professional council had about 15% of the overall vote, which was about 60% of that professional council, allocate it to Major League Soccer, the NWSL was right around the same amount, or even maybe just even a tad smaller than the USL, which is the Division II league, and the NWSL had only about 5%, or maybe just under 5%, which is three times the voting power for men's outdoor professional soccer than the women's outdoor Division I professional soccer. So this policy amendment, I think, would go a long way in helping us. We have a couple lawsuits on the women's side. Hope Solo, the U.S. women's national team, talking about, you know, not getting proper treatment, equal treatment, representation, etc. This amendment would go a long way to doing that. And in a country that has been kind of the flag bearer for the women's game for quite a while, and is, as you mentioned, kind of the envy of the world when it comes to the squad and the depth of the squad, I think that's a good step forward. When we look at where this country is and kind of looking over the next 4 or 5, 10 years, the competition's going to get stiffer. The coaching's getting better around the world. And these programs are on the rise. How important is it for the Federation to get it right in how they're treating this women's national team program in terms of resources, representation, et cetera?
Well, first of all, I think you and Chris should be commended for that work, because I think in 2019, if you're treating anybody in any walk of life different based on their gender or their race or their religion or anything like that, then you need a long, hard look at yourself. So you should be commended for that. And, you know, I certainly appreciate the work you're doing as somebody who works in the women's game. But I think for the US, when you are the most successful team and you are the one everyone wants to be, I think you need to assume the responsibility of being the flag bearer, the torch bearer, and of change and leading the way. So the hope is that US soccer realize how important that they are in the changing of the landscape and the changing of certainly lives of many young girls who are growing up playing youth soccer now, who would like to be a professional. That they don't take that responsibility lightly, and that they make sure they make all the changes to leave a better future and a better game and a more inclusive game for everyone. I think the US is the major nation in that they are the number one player.
Looking over the Atlantic for a moment, I wanted to pick your brain. Where do you think this English national team program is? Is it in good hands with Phil Neville, or you kind of at the point where you're like, maybe going forward, I want to look at somebody else in that spot? What do you think of where he's at, the job he's done up to this point, and the job he's doing at the present? Is he the right guy for the job, or do you think we need some new blood?
No, I like him. I think I don't think he deserves to lose his job. I think he's done a good job. I mean, let's face it, we're a missed penalty or a big toe of an offside decision away from being in the final. If you want to compare the two, you look at the men's job. We're very happy with what we got on the men's side, and he did the same on the women's side. So why should he lose his job? I've been disappointed by some of his comments lately. I think they've been a little bit aggressive and a tad arrogant. But I think he's done a good job. I don't think he deserves to lose it. There's nothing there that says he does. There's been a huge investment in the women's game in the last 12 to 18 months. It's increasing. The players are going to get better. So I think he should be judged on the job he's doing and continues to do going forward. I don't read too much into the friendlies. It's the games that matter. So, I mean, I'm certainly happy with him for now. I don't think he needs to go. But as we go forward and the landscape changes, and it is changing drastically every day at home, then obviously a bit like what I said about the US, when you have the investment and you have the players and you're making all the strides, the standard and the expectations go up. So it will certainly be interesting to see what happens as that increases.
Switching gears back over here, I wanted to ask you, there's been some speculation, some proposals in regards to college soccer in an extended season, longer season, kind of spreading some things out instead of being so compact. What are your thoughts on these proposals? And when you look at college soccer, what kind of changes, reforms would you want to see take place in order to improve the college game?
Oh God! Well, this is a tough one to answer because I think it varies deeply based on the program, based on the size of school. So I coached Division II men's last year at Cal State Dominguez Hills. Phenomenal facilities. You're based at the LA Galaxy. You get some great talent through there. I'm now coaching Division III women's here in Southern California. So it's going to depend entirely on the program, the division, the expectations of the players coming in. I can say from a logistical standpoint, regardless of the division, the season at the moment is I think it's detrimental to the physical aspect of the players, certainly to the mental aspect. It's far too intense. It's too much. The NCAA are very big on it being student-athlete and student-first. But the regulations that are put in place are crazy because they force everything into such a time. There's so much pressure upon it. You barely get any preseason at all. The games matter. I mean, you know, this thing where your record matters, even if you have a bad league conference, I struggle to get around that because you basically have, what, two scrimmages, then you're into games that count on the record, even though they count as preseason. So you don't really treat them as preseason. So the kids come in, you're running them to death, and then all of a sudden you're straight in. You're having two, three games in a week. And the NCAA wants you to give them time. They kind of force you to give them time. But if you had more time and it was spread out, you could give them more time. You know, so we play a game, we do a recovery session the next day. You then can't give them the day off the following day because you're probably playing again. Well, there's just no way. I mean, you heard Pep Guardiola talking about that this week about Man City. They're going to have to do it. And he's saying, I can't run any preparation. I just got to tell my players to get straight in the freezer and I won't talk to him. Well, I don't realize we've been doing that in the college game in this country for years and years and years, and it seems to be just taken as the norm. So it hasn't progressed. So I think the changes are long overdue. I think they really are long overdue. My concern is, you know, there's always going to be those that run it, that ruin it. You know, there's always going to be those that are still going to be running the same camps they run now, where the kids come in for double days and you just run the piss out of them every single day, every single session, and play and play and play. And they're going to be doing that now over 9 months. And so how's that going to affect their grades? How's that going to affect them getting jobs? How's it going to affect them having a social life? I think all of that is massively important. Again, depending on the division, depending on the size of the program, depending on the lifestyle that the kids who come in want. So it's a tricky one because I think it should be done certainly from a technical and tactical aspect and physical and mental. I think it's absolutely the right thing. I hope that it's taken on board. I hope that both genders do it. I hope that certainly the Division I programs take it on board. You know, for me now as a D3 program, coaching girls D3, you know, kids who go to a D3, it's not necessarily a talent thing, certainly in the women's game. It's maybe they want a different lifestyle. And so, you know, the thought of making a D3 program go all year round, I think, is detrimental to the reasons why they chose Division III. Last year at Division II on the men's, you know, I think those guys would have wanted to do it all year round. And so I think it varies. But certainly I think the Division I programs that have a responsibility or at least claim that they're involved in the production of talent that goes through the professional game, I think certainly it makes 100% sense for them, and it should have been done a long time ago.
Looking at this extended season, what kind of impact do you think it would have on leagues like the WPSL and the NPSL, leagues that have traditionally built their teams out on college players?
Honestly, I don't think it would have much impact because my 12 or 13 years here have taught me that the sporting culture here is massive, and actually trying to get kids to take a break seems to be the hardest thing. You know, you coach in the youth game, you got kids coming from basketball, they come to soccer, and then they go off to, you know, lacrosse or whatever they're doing. And it's like they don't get a chance to miss it. I think that personally, I think that's why the burnout rate is so high. Certainly in the women's game, you look at the transfer portal and how many kids just quit. It's staggeringly high, far too high. And again, there are some college legislation that I don't agree with that I think contributes to that. But I honestly don't think it would make a difference. I think the college kids would still play. I know for me growing up in England, it was like, you know, in the summer when you went for break, you either had to join the cricket team, which was basically just all the lads on your soccer team would just get together and make a cricket team because you didn't have anything else to do, or you just waited it out. But by the time season rolled around, you were absolutely chomping at the bit to get back out there. I've never really felt like kids out here have that. They're always doing something. They're always playing something. They never get the time to give their bodies a rest, give their mind a rest, give their emotions a rest. And, you know, get excited, give them chance to miss it. I think that's a massive thing.
Last point here on the college side of this conversation. California law just passed about being able to pay players earning money off their likeness, etc. What kind of impact, if that law stands and we see that start to be, you know, replicated across the country in other states, basically forcing the NCAA's hand on this whole amateurism aspect that they've held tight and fast to for a long time, to being able to open up to where, you know, players can earn money while in college playing the sport that they love. What kind of impact do you see on the college game if that is the case? Do you think kids might look at, hey, I can make some money while I'm in college, or do you think it would have very little effect on college soccer? What's your take on that?
When it came out, I was pleased because I think certainly in the other sports, in the more traditional American sports, your basketball and your football in particular, the amount of money the NCAA make off these kids is frightening. As far as soccer is concerned, it's interesting because kids are now, certainly in the men's game, they're starting to bypass college and sign, you know, homegrown deals or go to Europe and get their professionalism that way. So they're not so heavily reliant. We've seen one or two where that's starting to be the case in the women's game, but I don't think it's going to be as drastic. So I think it would keep more people, it would keep more talent perhaps to pursue college or at least consider it than perhaps is currently the landscape at the moment. But the money in college sports is interesting because I, you know, something like that is fine. But, you know, I was just talking to a player today at a D1 program, and, you know, she found out she got her money cut. And she didn't know. And so I find that really difficult, things like that really difficult, because we're not doing enough for these kids that come in. You know, if it was a professional game and you signed someone on a 4-year contract, you couldn't just decide, you know, on year two that they're not as good as you thought, or they're not doing the job you wanted, so you want to reduce it. That's the contract you signed. You know, I would like to see the scholarships be guaranteed for them, because I don't think they would be given out as freely. I think it would reduce the transfer rate. I think it would make recruiting a little bit more, I think it would, people would ease back on the recruiting because they would have to get it right. So there's a lot of things as far as the money's concerned in college that I think need to be looked at, because I certainly don't think that enough is being done for the kids. That's why a part of me is very, very pleased that the kids can make some money. But on the flip side, it's, are they going to go in and just go through the motions? Certainly in the main sport, in the main American sports, I think it's good for them because the NCAA makes an absolute fortune off them.
Yeah, I mean, we're not talking millions. We're talking billions, if anyone's paid attention. And it's a massive amount of money. And to see, you know, some kids, and I've seen kids, you know, who have, you know, aspired to play in the NFL, for example, and that's been their dream growing up, and they make it to college, and it, for whatever reason, maybe an injury occurs, maybe just, you know, you just didn't get it worked out. And maybe you make it to the NFL, you get a cup of coffee in the NFL, but it doesn't turn out to the career that you think you're going to have. I've always argued that, I mean, for a lot of players, college is the peak. It's the pinnacle.
For the vast majority in all sports.
Right. And so this idea that they should not be allowed to earn money while they're in college is just bizarre to me. And I'm happy to see that law passed. I think it is going to create pressure on other states and, frankly, on the NCAA.
It's worse than that, though. You know, even being a Division II coach, I couldn't print off a lad's homework for him in the printer in the office because the school charges kids to pay to print at the school. So if I printed it off for him on the office computer because the one in his dorm was broken, you know, even though it's only 75 cents or a buck or 50 cents or whatever it is, that would be an NCAA violation because I'm treating him different to the rest of the student population. But we're okay to wheel the kid out and sell tickets, $5 a game for people to come and watch the Division II level. The kid's not going to be a professional. You know, he's trying to be an athlete and we can't even print his homework off to save 50 cents. You know, so things like that are where the NCAA is totally, totally archaic. And so I'm okay with the kids getting their own back a little bit.
Me too. Completely agree. Jack, as always, it's great to have you on the show to pick your brain, and good luck out there with your college season going on right now. How can people follow your work online, social media, etc., to pick your brain, connect with you, and learn more about what you do?
Yeah, my Twitter is at JGidney88. You know, I know you put it up when you put the show up. But honestly, Twitter it gets a lot of stick. And some days it's the worst invention in the world, but some days it's the best. I've met some wonderful people, including yourself and your family, through it. I have great connections. I talk with a lot of great people, and I love it. So I could talk the game for days and days and days. So if anybody wants to give me a follow and just chat soccer, I'd love to. Absolutely love to.
You heard it here. I am a testament to that. That's how Jack and I first connected, and I have connected with so many people in that way as well. Jack, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time. Good luck as you continue through this fall college season.
Thanks, mate. Always a pleasure to speak to you. Say hi to the boys for me.
Thank you. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Now you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
Thanks for watching. Thanks for Jax for Jack for coming on the show. Really appreciate him stopping by the show today. As always, you can watch on facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. Catch me on Twitter or Instagram at Daniel Workman. We'll see everyone again tomorrow. Goodbye.